sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Stocks surge on stimulus hopes. Negative rates could be an option. And the most hated stocks are now getting the most love. Our guest today, Paul Merriman. All this and much more on episode number 433 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey, Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. It is starting the week of October 12th, 2015. Columbus Day is here. It's going to be a market open holiday for equities, and bonds will be closed on Monday, but we do have a good amount of data to sort through. It is the start of earnings season, and that is always a time that really the rubber meets the road when it comes to looking at what the current conditions are for stocks and companies, as well as what's happening in their guidance looking forward. And I thought we'd start with, before we get into too much detail with our guest, we'll get to him shortly. I wanted to start with the kind of the week that was, some of the things that have happened, some of the things that were pretty incredible with this week, because you remember last week there was a major turnaround in markets when the unemployment numbers came out. We saw that much fewer people put on the labor rolls, or the new jobs were added. And also the last 2 months were substantially revised lower. Now, initially, that dropped the futures down pre-market, because these numbers come out at 8:30 in the morning. Dropped them down very hard. They were up about 15, then they were down about 15, so about a 30-handle move on the S&P 500. I think the Dow was down about 250, and this was pretty ugly at first. Markets opened, and they started to absorb some of this data, saying, hey, wait a minute, you know what? If these numbers are that bad, and there's a trend that maybe we're going to see that employment is softer than it has been, even though this could be just an aberration at this point. Wow, the Fed's back in play. Because the Fed has really been all over the idea that while global slowdown, ex-US, has been a concern of theirs, they're more concerned with, of course, inflation and with the jobs number. Now, even though the unemployment rate stayed at 5.1%, there was clearly something going on. There was some technicals also, where we did see some bouncing off the lows, but clearly there was something else going on where there was the excitement, anticipation, and maybe the hope for new stimulus or continued stimulus efforts and a longer time till the Fed would actually hike rates. So what do we see? Well, last week, we actually saw the continuation of this move. We saw that the S&P 500 was up about 3.26% for the week. NASDAQ was up 2.61. The Dow is up 3.72% to finally get over, once again, that 17,000 mark. Now, probably the most astonishing thing that we did see last week was the continuation of the recent trend to a lower dollar amongst a basket of currencies. I think pretty much lower against 11 out of the 12 that are considered the key currencies around the world. And what's interesting is that this is very much different than we saw the last, maybe 2 months. In that period of time, we saw that there was a very significant correlation to dollar moving up and stocks moving up. Dollar moving down, stocks moving down. And all of a sudden, we're seeing that correlation break. And as a matter of fact, turn on its axis 180 degrees. And now dollar down is actually stocks up. Now, in addition to that, you also get some benefits for the material and commodity sector when it comes to dollar down, right? So you saw oil closed up very close. It actually went beyond 50 and came back a little bit, getting 9% for the week. Gold advanced also, gaining just about almost 2% for the week. and materials and commodity-related stocks were on fire. I mean, just on fire. So stocks all over the place, whether it was a Freeport, McMoRan, Glencore came back substantially. Alcoa did miss on their earnings and their outlook was just downright miserable. But one of the things that you're seeing is a combination, kind of a 1-2 punch in the commodity space. And let's take a look at that really quickly, what's going on. So if you look at the commodity space and you look that copper's rising and zinc is rising, two of the things that are really in play here are the fact that we saw the dollar move lower. And more importantly, a lot of companies are curtailing production, shuttering mines, taking down zinc production was taken down substantially by Glencore, copper production being taken down by Freeport and other companies. And it's a simple calculation and relationship, if you will, of supply and demand, right? Those are really what's happening here. So the moves were really pretty substantial and outsized. And you could say, well, really, they have been going down for some time. The metals have been under extreme pressure, stocks related to them under extreme pressure. And, you know, this is a bounce that is not only due, could it be a, you know, a simple dead cat bounce? Sure. But what's interesting is you also have on the heels of this, many companies looking at doing stock buybacks, which again is supply and demand. And that moved over into equity markets because volume was okay. There was some definite better volume on markets across the board for a couple of the days. But still, you did see that there was a major short squeeze. The week started off with the most shorted stocks that are available out there. This is from a Goldman Sachs list that they publish. These stocks were the most bought and the highest performers for the beginning of the week. So a short covering rally or a short squeeze is what started some of the action. Now, if you are ever talking to your friends or family or colleagues, and they start bringing up the whole idea that, well, I hate those short sellers. Man, short sellers should be banned from the markets. They just are terrible. They take down stocks. They do these awful things. You remind them that almost every rally off of a bottom starts with short sellers covering positions. Because when you get to that bottom point where nobody wants to buy anymore, none of the bulls that just go out and buy shares long are buying, well, who's left? And if that's not the case, then selling would continue and you would see no lift off the bottom of any considerable nature. However, because you have shorts out there that are looking to cover positions to lock in profits, what's happening is that they are the ones that are starting the whole squeeze, the rally. Now, this is not in every case, but clearly there is the exaggerated movement of equities when you have both buyers coming in off of a base and sellers or short sellers covering positions. So tell them they're just out of their minds that short selling is actually part and parcel of the markets. There's no reason that it shouldn't be allowed as long as it's done above board, of course, and legitimately following all the various procedures and rules. And realize that, you know, if you find the most heavily shorted stocks that are out there, stocks that have 50%, 60% of short interest, then the potential for them to rally off of good news is substantial. Because again, the short sellers are going to be squeezed. One of the other things you also saw last week, without doubt, was this rotation that we have talked about. This rotation that is moving from the leaders of yesterday, the technology stocks, the healthcare, biotechs in particular, into the materials, into the staples, into the commodity-related stocks, oil stocks, etc. Money's coming out. You can see it very clearly. Money is coming out of these names. Not all of them, but a good chunk of them. And it's rotating. It's trying to find a home somewhere. Question is, where do you go? Do you look for bonds right now? Well, maybe. You know, if the Fed is back in play, well, possibly we'll buy some bonds. But the truth of the matter is that there is still a lot of equity being desired to own. So why not find those stocks that are way off comparatively and rotate into there? It's called a mean reversion strategy, where over time, these stocks will come back up. So we find those that are the biggest ones that have taken the ones that have taken the biggest tumble and start putting money in there. And what happens is that this rotation begins, and that's what you're seeing. Now, whether or not this holds, if there's going to be further weakness in the global backdrop, that's a different question. But for right now, it seems that there is a substantial move and this rotation going on, particularly to the end of the year, because these are the stocks that can really hold up the S&P. If, in fact, the leaders just at least stay where they are, you could actually lift up equity values overall in a big way by buying into many of these that have been taken to the woodshed over the recent period. Now, let me give you just some more things that have gone on in the week. Of course, we saw that the Fed minutes came out last week, and that was further fuel for the bullish rally that went on, because it looked like the Fed was pretty darn bearish, even though they came out last official minutes talking about how, well, they're not going to raise right now because of this and that, but they still see the end of the year is the point when they're going to probably find a time that would be adequate to raise rates. But it did show that the Fed still was not in a majority with their, because there was a thought going through the market that for the most part, the Fed, the voting members were pretty much, many of them wanted to raise rates. When we look at the minutes going backwards, that's not what it actually said. It looked more like most of them were standing on the sidelines saying, hey, let's wait to see more data before we actually do something. We did see also that the ISM services index fell short of expectations. And we did see that the non-manufacturing purchase management index was at 56.9, still a very good number, but it was down from 59 the month before. And analysts had predicted about probably closer to 58 on this number. Now, I mentioned that this week is Columbus Day, but we have a lot of things happening. Let me tell you, primarily, we do have some important things. We have coming out on Tuesday, eBay, Intel, Johnson & Johnson, J.P. Morgan. They're going to be earnings, and that's going to be kind of important to watch what's happening with the banks, because they followed up on Wednesday with Bank of America, BlackRock. We got Netflix and Wells Fargo. Then we have coming out also on Wednesday, we have the producer price index will be another peek into the inflationary environment. And probably more importantly, from where I'm sitting, I'd like to see what's happening with the retail sales that we'll see also for the month of September. Then on Thursday, we're going to see more of the earnings coming out. Charles Schwab, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Philip Morris, Schlumberger. And then on Friday, earnings from GE, which obviously is having a nice little run right now as they are doing their best to shake off some of the parts of the company that do not make them as much money as they should. We have Honeywell, Progressive Insurance, and SunTrust. And then we have, finally, the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index for October, the initial reading for October. So all this will be coming up. It's going to be a pretty action-packed week starting on Tuesday. So I think that's something that we need to keep an eye on. A couple other things I want to talk about. And by the way, after we talk with Paul Merriman, I'm going to come back with an important discussion about Volkswagen, something I think you need to hear, some things that really haven't been discussed with this and some things you need to think about. But before we do that, let's talk about, let's see here. I want to talk about this. This is interesting. So I was thinking, we look at, we have a variety of proprietary market indicators that we've developed that we use as a, to look at a viewpoint of where markets are, what are the trends, and, you know, where are they positioned in terms of being overbought, oversold, et cetera. Now, we use this key reversal indicator as a checkup on how things are doing, finding turning points in the markets, if there are going to be any of those. It's a pretty, I would say this, it's a pretty good measure of points that are so oversold or overbought that I like to take a look at that with other things, because you can't just rely on one thing, but other things also to see where things are playing in the markets. And also then I look at those to see, okay, well, if it's showing that there's an extremely overbought circumstance, like there is right now, by the way. Right now we have a five out of, really out of six. Six is kind of like, wow, we are really overbought. Like, woo, something's going to happen here. Markets cannot continue this for much longer. There must be a pullback coming within the next 3 days to 5 days at the maximum. It may not be like a major crash or anything like that, but just, you know, it was a little bit of a take back, a back and fill, let's call it. But I was thinking how it's important to check this strategy every once in a while, to look back on how it's done in different times, kind of in hindsight. And then we're starting to think about, what do you do to check yourself? What do you do to make sure that your strategy, your process, your signals are really doing you justice? Or are you abandoning them entirely? You need to make sure that you have some things that can direct you on the big picture. Stock by stock, investment by investment, you can clearly look at what's happened. But what about stepping back? Kind of sitting back in your chair for a second and looking at the markets objectively from a perspective of what? What do you do? What are you using? Using a stochastic? Using the S&P, the small caps, large caps? What are you doing? A lot of different ways to do it. IBD, Investors Business Daily, for example, has a process where it looks at leading stocks, volume, rally attempts, days from the rally attempt to a follow-through day, and then they can call a market an uptrend, downtrend, or whatever else may be inside of their overall spectrum of how markets are trending. We use things like, and some people, by the way, some people use moving averages, 50, 200, 100. Look at crossovers, MACD, stochastics, things like that. So I just want to make sure that you're using something from a market standpoint, because you know 70% or so of stocks will follow markets around. So keep that in mind and realize that we need to be very cognizant of where markets are playing in terms of their trend to understand what our exposure should be, how aggressive we want to be on the long and the short side. Okay? So just some food for thought there. Write this down. Take a look at what is your process of understanding that, because that should be one of the signals of, am I buying now? Okay, maybe I'll nibble in a little bit because we're still in a downtrend. I just want to maybe buy a few shares of this stock. And then when we see a big uptrend happen in the markets and a turning point, then I'm going to go full position. So those are a couple of things that are just on my mind. When we get back, I want to talk about Twitter. I want to talk about Volkswagen and a few other things. Well, let's get to our guest, and that's Paul Merriman. He's a writer for MarketWatch.com. He's an author of a couple of books, the latest being Financial Fitness for Everyone. He's the host of a podcast that is called Sound Investing and the founder of Merriman Financial Educational Foundation. We welcome here today to talk about all sorts of good stuff. Paul, how are you?
I'm doing great. Great to be with you, Andrew.
All right, thanks. Listen, I got so many things I want to talk to you about. I know you have a new article that came out that was really interesting on MarketWatch just a couple of days ago. And I wanted, one of the things that you've written about recently that really perked or piqued my interest was this article about bear markets, because I think that the whole idea of corrections and bear markets and, you know, all that's been swirling around lately, we haven't really seen too much of that in the last number of years, of course, but I think people forget that they are out there and kind of hiding out in the nooks and crannies that could come. So I thought we'd talk about some of this. That, you know, what is a bear market, for example? I mean, what do you qualify as a bear market?
Well, it's typically considered a 20% decline over a couple of months. I mean, you could have a very short-term decline that wouldn't necessarily be considered a bear market. But that's, and by the way, that's not about individual stocks. It's about market indices, a broader look at the market rather than a very specific narrow niche.
Right. So it would be a 20% decline. And when you do see that, of course, on a market index like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, the underlying stocks usually get pretty hit pretty hard, much harder than the index oftentimes.
Well, you're certainly going to have a number that are going to be hit harder. I mean, it's the old story about the about the kid that drowns walking across the river with an average depth of 2 feet. Yes, there are going to be some things that are going to be devastating. Think back to the bear market of 2000 through 2002, when you had the NASDAQ down about 80% compared to the S&P 500 down about 50.
Ugh, that's ugly. And obviously, it's very painful and it keeps people from getting back and people make all the wrong decisions. But how often do bear markets come and what is the likelihood of a bear market hitting, actually?
Well, if we look at averages, they happen about every 3.4 years. Mm. That's bad. That's often.
That's, yeah.
And the average decline is about 35%. Now, what that decline does not include are the dividends being reinvested. Mm-hmm. So it's still bad. But I think what's important about that, Andrew, is that people need to create reasonable expectations of the process of being a successful investor. And if you don't set your horizon on having to live through those kinds of declines, you better find another way to participate in the market.
Yeah. And one of the things you talk about, actually, is that, you know, you can look at bear markets. I mean, there's two ways to look at it, right? One way is, oh, my God, I just lost all this money, right? And that's assuming that you were fully invested and you had, you know, everything set up to be long, and you get painfully concerned and you just throw everything out and you lose all that money. And then who knows what happens. On the other side, you can look at it as, hey, you know what? What a great buying opportunity if all the different things line up correctly. So I think that was really good in the article in terms of the concept of, you know, why don't you just look at it objectively? I guess that's kind of what I took away from it. Look at it objectively as, you know, what does this say? Is it really, oh my God, it's just going to keep going down forever. I'm going to lose everything. Everybody's going out of business. Every company's going out of business. Or, okay, maybe it's a point that there is some bargains out there that maybe something that I can buy into, right?
Well, if you're a young investor, it's the best thing of all that could happen to you is an opportunity to pile in to great companies at low prices. Remember, there has never, ever been a permanent bear market in a diversified portfolio.
Right.
Enron represents a permanent. WAMU represents permanent bear market.
Right, yeah.
But not if you're diversified. And I think that's important because that's the hope we all live with, that we'll have a better day and we will receive the premium for the risk that we're taking in equities.
Right. So the most recent market structure that we've had over the last, let's call it 15, 20 years, we've only seen really from, let's just start with, you know, 2000. We've seen two bear markets that were pretty vicious, of course. We've seen, they were about
huge.
7 years apart, though, which bucks the average trend time, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, averages are not representative of real life, unfortunately. And I don't think many people expected in a 15-year period to be hit by two huge bear markets. Think about it, Andrew. The S&P 500 has compounded at less than the 4% over the last 15 years. What people forget is from 1980 through 1999, it compounded at 18% a year. So what it gives, it takes back sometimes.
Yeah, I hear you. So the thing is that obviously one of the things that I you wrote about this is you have 22, this article is entitled 22 Things You Should Know About Bear Markets. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting is you talk about a number 21, where is a bear market really bad? Like, What could be really bad about a bear market? And you're right, with something that I've talked about so many times is, well, if you're unlucky enough to retire right before the bear market begins, you know, a few days before, and now you're relying on your portfolio to provide you with income and growth over time, and this bear market hits, there's a big problem. And it's all a matter of perspective and timing, I guess. Well, not timing as in market timing, but I'm timing of when this all happens. So how does somebody protect themselves in that circumstance?
Well, I think what you need to do is assume that that's going to happen to you, and that means that you have to have your portfolio from the day you retire. And for many people, when I was an investment advisor years ago, I used to try to get them to pretend they were retired maybe 5 years before they got there, just so they started to cool their jets. But I think you've got to have enough money in your portfolio in bonds in order to protect against that downside. I've done a lot of work at my website, paulmerriman.com, on distributions. How much can you take out? When can you take it out? How can you take it out? You do it right, and the likelihood is the money's going to last you a lifetime. You do it wrong, and you're setting yourself up for having to move in with your kids, and that is the ultimate bear market.
Oh, yeah, that's permanent. Back to that again. So just as a point of reference, I think it's a good time to mention this, that I know you have a couple of free ebooks over on the site too, right?
I do. One is called First Time Investor, Grow and Protect Your Money, and the other, it's a long title, but it's a great book, 101 Investment Decisions Guaranteed to Change Your Financial Future.
Yeah, that's long. That is definitely, I agree with you there. But that's good, it's over 100. All right, so let's kind of just go to a few things. So you also mentioned that in terms of a bear market, the last one ended, well, the last one started in 2009 or ended in 2009, depending on how you want to look at the movement, yes. Of course. So statistically, we're overdue about it. But one of the things that I've noticed about, well, we'll call it corrections, bear markets, whatever you want to call these. And this is a bigger discussion. It's not that we're trying to identify what exactly is a bear market. And then you say, oh, that's a bear market and do something about it. It's the concept of the trend. It's the concept of the movement and the psychology of the markets, et cetera. Usually what you find is that oftentimes the downstrokes due to psychological changes in markets and sentiment happen. It takes a longer time to set in, but then when it does happen, the movement is very vicious and very fast, as opposed to a lot of times when you see a general uptrend of markets, it's kind of more relaxed. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. In fact, the average bear market only lasts about 10 months.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of pain in a relatively short period of time. And you and I know, having been around the industry, that pain translates into a loss of hope, a loss of dreams, a loss of a whole bunch of things that people didn't understand that was part of the process. And this is why I believe that virtually everybody, and I even have an investment advisor, Andrew, mm-hmm. I think all of us need to have somebody in our life to be that 2x4 that they whack us over the head every once in a while to make sure that we're within the reality of the world. And so that's what I think is going to make the difference, is if you, whether on your own or with professional help, are you prepared for these bad things that happen? And what do you do? When do you rebalance? And when do you start going from a certain amount of fixed income to more fixed income and to more fixed income? Those things can all be built into a plan that should make your money last a lifetime.
Right. You know, the thing, though, that's interesting is the opposite of what you say is true also, in terms of, you say, well, you know, we get this bear market and you got loss of hopes and people are kind of like, oh my God, I'm never going to make it back. Things are never going to be good again. You know, they get that whole mentality going on, right? You know, this. But, you know, at the same time, when we have a market that people are just buying the dips because things will always be better and things always come back, and when we have a market that is slowly but surely being, you know, money's being pumped in for liquidity, and the outcome of that is that we see a slow sloth up for a number of years, as we've seen recently, the opposite is quite true as well, where people are like, well, it's never going to go down again. You know, I mean, we have the same thing, but opposite.
I know.
And I think people have to be very aware of the fact that that is just as dangerous as giving up any kind of, I don't want to say hope, because hope is kind of a, you know, I don't believe in hope in terms of investing, more of a strategy, but they get rid of their philosophy of what investing is all about and the process and the strategic moves that need to be made from time to time to make sure that you are properly allocated, right?
Well, I totally agree. Personally, with my own money, half of it is with buy and hold. I mean, real buy and hold using index funds.
Mm-hmm.
The other half is with trend following market timing. I just love that combination, Andrew. The idea that almost in any market environment, I'm looking good with part of my portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that hope is an important part, or trust. Maybe the word is trust, that you're doing the smart thing for you and your family, because it's not just about our lives. It's what survives us that I'm trying to get people to think in terms of. And I believe that successful investing at the end of the day is 99.9% defense, not offense.
But how do people play defense right now when bond prices have been just skyrocketing over the years? again, the last few months, let's put that aside for a second, what's happened with bonds, you know, the kind of the credit spreads are widening. And, but put that aside for a second. When we have a situation where we have a government or governments buying up bonds like crazy, bringing the prices up, bringing yields down to a point that is, I guess I would say be the best way to, it's warped. It's not properly balancing the risk reward scenario. And where do you go from here? I mean, bonds are not going to have negative yields. Well, they could, they do in Europe, but generally speaking, you're not going to bid up prices of bonds. You're not going to pick up a 2% bond at 125, let's say, dollars par, and then hope that what, you know, that's going to go negative one day. So how do people actually go out these days? The old days, I understand, you had a reasonable level, you had a 5% bond that was trading at, let's call it 198, 102. But now yields long term, if they're going to ever, if they're going to ever normalize, isn't that going to be problematic?
Well, it will be problematic. Just as owning equities during a period of time that equities are going down is problematic. My view is this. I invest on a 100% mechanical approach at all times. There's always list A, the good news. There's always list B, the bad news. I have no idea how to deal with those two lists. So my strategies are all about making it mechanical. I have Vanguard portfolios at my website for people who are aggressive, who are moderate, who are conservative. I have fixed income for people who want a monthly check and fixed income for people who want to simply have the have that fixed income as a defense against the equity portion going down substantially. But once we figure out who we are, and you know that the most difficult part of this whole process is not figuring out the market, it's figuring out the client and what they believe and what they will believe tomorrow when another story comes out. That's the tough part, is understanding the client and the client's needs and being able to manage those, if you will, what's the word I'm looking for, dynamics, rather than the market. Ignore the news about the market.
Right.
That's not part of my decision making because I don't know how to deal with 200 variables.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, but you ignore it in terms of the incremental pieces that come out, but by using trend following techniques, you're picking up on it in your investing.
It's all built into the process.
Right. Exactly.
But I let the market dictate what I do in the market timing part, not how I feel.
Right. No, I hear you. Well, yeah, using gut and feel, and I think, and using emotions of any sort, we know that are, you know, it's very dangerous. Let's talk about your recent article came out about 12 ways to lose $1 million. And you go through a variety of things. You know, the old joke. You know, how do you make $1 million? Well, you give a stockbroker $2 million, right?
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
you know, that's what you'll have left. But You talk about a variety of things here. You say, I mean, the first thing you say in this article and in the first bullet point is exactly what we've been talking about here, which is, you know, following your emotions and bailing out of your investments too quickly. Now, I mean,
this is what happened in after the bear market of 2000 through 2002, 2007 through 2009. It ate away at people until they bailed out. And we can remember what it was like in March of 2009, and people were panicked, and it was the end of the world. And then they sat on cash a year or two or three. When you miss one 25% move in your lifetime, it is likely, if you're a regular saver of $5,000 a year for your lifetime, it's going to cost you $1 million because you panicked and lost that 25% upside opportunity.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting because it probably, what I tell a lot of people is that, you know, when should I add to this position? Now, again, it depends on the position, depends on the stock, depends on the mutual fund or whatever it is that they're investing in. And there's a couple of things they say. You know, one is, first of all, when it seems like it's never getting any better, when it seems like, you know, this is it, it's, you know, going down, you can't take it anymore, you're at wit's end, it's just, that's it. Sometimes that could be the best time to invest. And on the other hand, you know, some people say, well, what if I put stops in? And we use stops in our portfolios for certain strategies. And I got to tell you something. I can't tell you how many times stops end up actually costing us. But A lot of times they're beneficial too. I mean, they're very beneficial, but, you know, depending on where you are. If the stop is, you know, at the bottom of the bottom of the bottom, you know, you may want to rethink using a stop rather than buying more. You know, but, you know, if it's a top stop where, you know, the stock is, okay, we got a target of 105, if the stock's at 80 and it hits that 105, that may be a good way to play it. But, you also have, procrastinate. That's something that is, on your list. And we all know that we looked at these charts and said, oh, if I started saving for my IRA at age 20 or 22 or 24, 25, I mean, there's a big differential by the time I'm 60, right?
Well, if you look at $5,000 a year over 40 years earning 8%, you end up with $1,000,003. If you wait, if you procrastinate for 5 years, put away that same $5,000, make the same 8%, you make $861,000. That $25,000 investment that you made for having given up what you could have spent that money on gives you another $433,000 to retire on. It is huge, right. And this is the problem. People underestimate the impact of compounding over a period of time. I talk to high school kids. We talk about inflation. I say, what will a 5-cent piece of bubble gum cost with 3% inflation over 2,000 years? They don't even get it close. It's $2.3 trillion dollars. And the piece of gum will be smaller, Andrew.
Well, of course, naturally.
But that's the thing. The whole compounding thing is way misunderstood, and it's my hope that I can help these young people figure that out, because then they'll start early, I hope.
Yeah, it's like the penny a day doubled for 31 days. You've done that one?
That's it.
Yep, exactly.
That's it.
And if you don't know what we're talking about, that's, you know, give it somebody a choice. I'm going to give you a summer job. The job is either you get $1,000 a day for 31 days for a month, or take a penny and double it for every day for 31 days. It goes from a penny to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16, 32, 64, $1.28, blah, 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 all the way. Well, by the time you reach, I don't know, day 20-ish, something like that, the money starts to add up and it's looking really good. And then by the time you're done, I don't know what the number is, but it's a very large number with a lot of zeros.
It's huge.
It's huge.
Yeah. Yep. That's a great lesson for young people.
You also talk about not taking enough risk. Now, here's interesting, because there's two sides of this, right? So one thing is I don't take enough risk, or maybe I guess if we combine these two, it's not appropriate risk. Maybe that would be the center of all this, right? So not taking enough risk and taking too much risk is potential problems.
Yeah, I think taking too much risk, which is a problem that young people often face because somebody has convinced them there's easy money to be made. It's easy to beat the market, and for some reason they preach you have to beat the market. No, you don't have to beat the market. If you can be the market, you'll be filthy rich. But that early speculation is not so different than the early investing. You blow that early money, and you have blown gold. And it's not only about losing money for yourself. It's also about losing money for your heirs. And young people don't think about their heirs, which is something else I try to impress on kids, the difference they can make on others if they just do it right now.
Yeah, you know, see, I think it's interesting because we have several different strategies that we run for clients. And, you know, they cover the gamut of risk, you know, well, and strategy. And, you know, it's interesting because when you look at people and what they talk about, you know, out of their mouth. Well, I don't like risk. As an example, you know, you talk to a client. I don't like risk. Meanwhile, you take a look at their portfolio that they're, you know, they want you to review that they have over at, you know, a brokerage house or something. You're like, wait a minute. Do you see what you have in your portfolio? Well, yes. You said you really don't like risk. I'm giving an example here, but you don't like risk. Meanwhile, you're loaded up with all tech stocks. Well, these are quality. Wait a second. Wait a minute. You know what I mean? If we would have said this 5 years ago, it would have been a much different discussion. Anyway, so I think that's kind of an interesting point. You mentioned that you in a variety of these things that you mentioned, you talk about, which I think is really important and a lot of people don't get, is never turn down the opportunity to cash in on a profit. I mean, I think that's something that is very difficult because it's the opposite extreme of getting out of something as it's moving down. The difficulty of people to move out of something or take a profit as something maybe moved up to a price, it's very difficult. What is it, greed?
Yeah, I think it's, you feel like a winner. I don't even know if it's about greed. It's about self-esteem, which is, I think, something different. And when they can take a profit, regardless of how small it is, the one thing they know they don't have to say is that I took a loss. Mm. And that's a big deal. And that's why a lot of people, after they've gotten into something they thought they were going to make money quick, and then it all of a sudden turns down, they don't get out until they can get back up and break even. And that can wipe out a fortune over a lifetime, just there sitting waiting to break even. The emotions. I wish every one of your listeners would read Your Money and Your Brain by Jason Zweig. Mm. It is an amazing a book about how crazy we all are when it comes to investing. All of us have need of therapy about money. Well. And that book is just excellent.
Mm. You know, I call this the golf course mentality. So it's like, okay, hey, buddy, how you doing? You get to the third or fourth hole. What's going on? Oh, man, I just had a winner. What do you mean? Oh, I just cashed out 42% on blah, blah, blah stock. Oh, really? Oh, yeah. And you know what? 2 weeks ago, I had this other one I made like 18% on. I'm like, oh, that's fantastic. You know, but when's the last time somebody came on the golf course and said, all right, hey, nice shot. Hey, by the way, I lost 24% on the stock last week.
Yeah, you're right.
You just don't hear
it. You're right. People are not honest about these things. Well, Andrew, I got to tell you, this has been a joy to work with you.
I appreciate your time.
I live on an island.
Oh.
If I don't leave now, I miss the ferry and I miss lunch with my daughter.
Oh, well.
Oh, my God.
Perfect timing. Perfect timing. Listen, I want to thank you. Everybody can check out all the information that is regarding the free ebooks, et cetera. We're going to have that on the show notes for this episode. Paul, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew. I hope we do it again.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye. And moving right along, I thought we would talk about, just for a moment, spend a little time talking about both two things. Twitter, the news that was the Friday night, late after the close, kind of news purge, where Recode came out with an announcement that Twitter is going to be doing some cross-the-board layoffs. And in fact, further information came out that talked about them possibly even stopping some of the development and the build out of one of their new offices that they're going to be building. They have an office that I think they either share the building with Square, which is kind of convenient for Jack Dorsey, the new part-time CEO. But this announcement about layoffs, oftentimes when a company announces layoffs, there's a lot of reasons why, but sometimes you see the stock actually pop, that investors are saying, hey, that's great. We're cutting costs. And, you know, in a time when possibly revenues are slowing down, and this is a really good thing, first step or one of the steps in a company's process to bringing back really good profitability and maybe some growth. The problem is that Twitter is supposed to be already a growth company. It's supposed to already be continuing to grow. And when we see that there is going to be jobs cut and mass layoffs, or at least some layoffs of their 4,000 employees that, by the way, since their IPO, I think they went from somewhere around 2,000 or just under 2,000 employees to now 4,000 employees. And clearly there is some efficiencies that are lacking. Either that or the need to reduce down overall expenses, maybe because revenue is slowing, which we do know about. User growth is slowing. We know about that as well. So Jack Dorsey is looking for ways to cut back, make sure that there is much more efficiency, and to obviously do better, a better job for the investors in the stock. The problem is a problem, that it seemed that after the news came out, now this is after the close on Friday, so trading is thin, but about 300,000 shares traded, and Twitter traded down about 3.5%. They also announced a few other things last week, like this new Moments, which is, I guess, a culmination of news stories that pop up in a new tab and in a new area on the mobile app. I tried to look at it. I don't really get what the benefit is. Now I'm all of a sudden, in theory, following people that I didn't want to follow or I haven't followed. Now, maybe it's good that I see that because I can follow more people and there's more opportunity for this curation of news to be spread, because I think that Twitter does have a really good ability to be a place that you can instantly find news if you subscribe or follow the right sources. But I'm still not really a fan of this whole part-time CEO thing. I'm not a fan of what they have done with regard to their overall management of the company. I'm not really a fan of the lack of ability for them to gain any kind of user growth and real momentum there. Let's face it, there's a lot of other alternatives. And I think that this may be taken as a sign to investors that maybe things are a lot worse internally because we have about a week or so, or maybe 2 weeks, until earnings are due. And maybe ahead of that, Jack Dorsey is saying, hey, you know what? We got to show that we're serious here. We got to show that we're going to do something, because if we're not seeing any kind of significant user expansion, the membership, the monthly active users that they use to count, which, by the way, clearly goes to show you how full of crap Dick Costello was, who is now, by the way, working as a writer on the set of an HBO comedy. No kidding. He would have come on and talk about, maybe that's the whole point. It was a big comedy to him. He would come on and tell you, hey, don't follow the monthly active users, follow the total users. Then the next month, oh, don't follow the total users. You need to follow this other metric we have. That was the sign that something was definitely not kosher over at Twitter. Something wasn't right, where we kept on getting different statistical measures to follow by the CEO. And obviously we know what happened there. It also, I think, is a really big red flag that it took him this long to hire a CEO, and all they came up with was the same name that's been swirling around for months, and they could only do it on a part-time basis because he's also the CEO of Square, which is IPOing soon, which is going to require a lot of his time and attention. So keep a look at what's going on with Twitter next week and into earnings. We'll see how the stock plays out, if in fact it will turn around on Monday and the investors will look at it as a really good thing that they are taking the bull by the horns and firing people. Not that it's good to fire people, but letting people go for an expense benefit, or if that just leaves them even more vulnerable because they should be expanding at this point, not pulling back. Let's take a journey over to, just for a moment, into Volkswagen world. There's been a lot of questions about what Volkswagen did, how they did it, what was the knowledge base of the company with regard to this, who knew, who didn't, was it widespread, was it just a couple of people? And when we look at the fallout from this, it's clearly that there's a lot of trust that has been lost in the company, and the fact that we are seeing a substantial amount of what I would say, I guess it would be just scrambling to figure out what they're going to do to maintain profitability in light of the fact that many people are questioning if they're going to buy cars from Volkswagen. And we already saw that a couple of preliminary numbers from different countries showed that the sales were down substantially post the news of this diesel fuel scandal, the emissions test scandal. We also saw over the weekend that there may be more to this. It looks like there may be further ways that the company had looked to get past various emissions tests, so it is now not just a one-off situation. And that they were hiding through some technology where they were able to pass an emissions test based on the criteria for this diesel and this low emissions requirement that was for the EPA. But only when the car was being tested. There was some kind of technology that could figure out when the car was being tested and therefore change the settings to a setting that was much more or less efficient for the car, much more kind to the emissions tests. And therefore, what happened was that it would pass tests, but when you got back on the road, it switched into this other mode that would actually be much greater in terms of torque, in terms of performance, in terms of fuel consumption, but emissions were off the charts, really bad. So not only did the company just simply do this, it seems like there's something else that's in the works, to a point that they took plans off selling the diesel cars in 2016. So basically, they tricked the emission tests. And now there's some more news coming out that there's more like this that recently happened. But there's something that I don't think a lot of people in the news media and analysts are really focusing on, at least from what I've seen. I was thinking about all the different possible class actions that could be brought against Volkswagen, and there's just a lot of them, from the various global agencies that are going to be looking into the emissions and the cheating and trickery and the scandal, to individuals who are losing money on cars because they bought this car and they thought it was one thing and it's another, to car dealers who are going to be stuck with many of these cars in the inventory, to also other people who maybe bought a car a few years ago, trying to sell it. Now it's worth a lot less. So they overpaid for the car to begin with because of this clean diesel technology. To this little ditty that I was thinking about. You see, a lot of cars were bought on lease, right? I mean, people buy cars on leases all the time. When they buy a car on lease, one of the things the leasing company does is that they calculate the cost of the car over the period with a few different features. First, they look at the factor of, let's say, what's the interest rate, what's the time period, what's the money you're putting down, but more importantly, what's the residual factor, the residual price that they will look at as to when they actually get the car back. So let's say that somebody has a $20,000 car, and the car is has a 3-year lease, and the residual value is 50%. That means that the assumption is that when the car comes back to the leasing company after 3 years, that they will put a price tag on it of $10,000. Now, if you want, you could buy it from them for $10,000 at that point in a simple lease. And maybe if you want to sell it on your own, if you think you can get $12,000 for it, let's say, well, that's a nice little arbitrage that you did. But oftentimes when you just give back the car, essentially what happens is that the leasing company was anticipating that they could sell the car for $10,000. The money that you gave them through the time, through the monthly installments, you add that plus the interest rate, and that was obviously the total cost for the car. And then you book those profits, etc. Now, if the leasing company now has to drop down the residual value assumptions on cars that are currently on lease, so therefore, what they did is they thought they can get $10,000 to sell the car at the back end of the lease and gain all their money back, etc. Maybe now they could sell it for $7,500. $2,500 is now a loss that the leasing company is going to have to assume. Volkswagen Credit is a big leasing agency for Volkswagen. A lot of the cars went through, of course, that and other, but Volkswagen Credit for leases. And now Volkswagen Credit is going to have an impairment potentially on their balance sheet for all the cars that are out there that have a lower residual value in actuality than was initially assumed when they created these leases. Could it be 10%, 15%, 20%, 30%? I would say that the thing is that while they've had a higher value on these cars because of their clean diesel technology, and it was a Volkswagen they sold over market to begin with, now all of a sudden you're going to have a significant, possibly 25 to 30% reduction in the value of the residual on the cars that are currently out there. Now, they have 11 million cars, so they're on the road. Many of those are in Europe. Europe doesn't do as much leasing, I don't believe, as the U.S., so that's good. But still, there is a major problem here that is going to flow down into the leasing companies, where the leasing companies are going to have a major problem with this. Leasing companies book these values with, again, a valuation based on this former number. And I would think that we'll probably see, if there is in fact this problem, debt offerings that will be coming out soon by these leasing companies, particularly VW Credit, because they're going to have to fill the holes of some of these losses that they're going to have on their credit. Now, I would also think that maybe S&P and Moody's may drop the ratings on some of VW's bonds if there is an affiliation, and they see that as an affiliation with Volkswagen Credit, which, again, different company, but part of the company. And I think this is going to come out to light and be a much bigger problem for Volkswagen, and tie that into the secondary news that came out over the weekend. And I think now Volkswagen has a really big problem. They've been talking about how this is not going to tarnish their image as a company, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I don't know how it doesn't. You know, I don't know how you trust a company. Where else did they skimp? Where else did they, cut corners to produce a car? We know they're pretty safe cars from all safety tests, unless they fake those somehow too, which I don't think is possible, but you never know. But the fact is that I would really have my antenna up for what the ramifications for Volkswagen, and if we do see this really morph into something very serious, much more and much more costly, and they have to lay off employees, I also think this could really bleed into the German economy substantially. So this is something that I want you to keep an eye out for, okay? Take a look at Volkswagen, the stock. Maybe it's something you want to put option on. Maybe you want to look at it as the potential for a short, something that we're looking at as well. Anyway, I want to talk to you about that. If you have any questions, of course, you can write me at any time. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Follow me on Twitter. And other than that, I'm going to bid you adieu, and I'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me so much. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.